Perhaps that would give me somewhere solid to stand. I pulled on thick leather gloves and tied a cloth over my face before passing a second cloth to Naomi and reaching for the jars of arsenic left by the room's original inhabitants. We had both the white powder form, perfect for poisoning enemies, and the pure metal, flaky and gray. Step one, I decided, would be to burn it. Different metals produced different color flames when thrown into a fire, and if the arsenic was distinctive enough, we could simply burn some of the food to detect it. There was no chance that the solution would be that simple, but it was a good place to begin. I lit a candle and broke off a piece of pure arsenic with my tongs. Naomi stepped back, her face covered too. I held my breath as I pushed the arsenic into the flame. The fire turned blue, and a garlicky smell filled the room. "You did it?" Naomi said, shifting closer. She sounded unsure. "Not yet." I placed the pure arsenic in a bowl and snuffed the flame. It's the powder that's used to poison people. If that has the same reaction... It didn't. I couldn't hold the powder in my tongs, so I lit another candle and sprinkled it on top, letting it settle in the slight dip of melted wax. Nothing happened. At least, nothing I could identify. The smoke might have been a little thicker, perhaps, but the powder just sat there, completely uninterested in doing anything useful. I took notes anyway, making sure I didn't leave out a single detail. That garlic smell felt like the key here. If I could get the powder to release the same gas, then it would be easy to detect. My pen was too loud as it scratched the paper. I could feel Naomi watching me. "It'll be all right, you know," she said softly. "I know. The answer's here somewhere." "That's not what I meant." She touched my shoulder. "I meant court, the funerals, all of it. I know you can do it." I chewed my lip. "I wasn't made for this, Naomi. I was supposed to leave. I was supposed to be doing science, not worrying about court gossip and fashion and the right way to smile. I was supposed to escape all this. I don't fit here." "Freya, do you think I'm selfish?" Naomi stared at me. "Freya, no, of course not. You, I think I am." I stared at the stains on the table. It seemed so important suddenly to say it out loud, not to get Naomi's reassurance that I was wrong. What would be the point? But to let myself accept that I was right. I'd found a huge flaw deep within me, one I'd previously thought was a strength. What was I supposed to do with that? "Fitzroy, he's not who I thought he would be, and Madeline, when she bumped into me, she just wanted to talk about charity, about orphans. And I thought maybe she was just putting on an act, but I think she really is like that. I think she really does care. And I always dismissed her because she fit in and I didn't. How can I be the queen of these people when I think like that? I wouldn't even accept me." "Freya, listen." Naomi pulled her stool closer, so we were practically sitting on top of each other. She wrapped an arm around my shoulders, and I sank into the strange sideways hug. "I don't think you're selfish. Things were different before. You didn't feel like you fit in here. Neither of us did. You wanted to leave. Of course you didn't want to make friends or think the people making you miserable were nice, but now things are different. Now you're part of it. You're seeing things differently too. And that's okay, isn't it? It means you aren't selfish. You're thinking about them as people. That's all right. That's what you need to do." "I don't know." I closed my eyes, shifting closer. Her hair tickled my nose. "How am I ever going to understand them? They're just people, Freya. You'll be all right." But even that thought was terrifying. People were complicated. I'd never be able to please them all. More visitors poured through the fort's gates the following day. Since none of these nobles had been at the banquet that night, and many barely knew the victims, they didn't talk in the same somber tones as most of the survivors. They greeted one another with enthusiasm, their voices swelling in speculation. When I passed them in the corridors, they would fall silent, bowing and curtsying, before resuming their gossip as soon as I was out of sight. I tried to smile, as my mother had, to walk as though the corridors belonged to me. I needed the visitors' approval, as my father had told me, over and over again. They held far more power than any ruler would like to admit. They collected the taxes in their regions. They were the face of law and justice to whoever lived under their rule. Common people knew them, respected them, or feared them, as the case may be, and they had old families, old connections, knowledge of the land and resources that the crown never saw. I needed their support. How could someone declare themselves queen in one city when all the land around disagreed? I had no chance to go to my laboratory. Instead, I practiced my speech with my father until I knew it so well that my ghost would probably recite it in these halls 1,000 years from now. I answered Holt's questions about cutlery and curtsies, and whenever I had a spare moment, I scribbled down ideas for conversations, phrases I could say, anything to make me feel more prepared. Naomi helped me to dress in near silence, pinning my hair up so it looked like a spiraling black pastry balanced on my scalp. It looked ridiculous, I thought, as Naomi added another 10 pins to ensure it stayed in place. But it was a familiar style. I just needed to be familiar. Naomi dusted silver over my eyelids and tied me into another huge skirt, layered with cascading silk and studded with yet more jewels. It swamped me, making my face and hands look inhumanly small, and I scowled at my reflection, willing it to shift into proportion. When my father came to collect me, he looked calm and confident, as he always did in court, but he worried the edge of his sleeve with his thumb as he nodded his approval. He was nervous. We met Holt outside the throne room. He looked over my dress, my hair, my jewels, and he frowned, but he didn't get a chance to speak before my father barreled ahead. "Do you remember your speech?" I nodded, feeling too sick to reply. "The Forgotten are with you, Your Majesty," Holt said. "Even now, have faith that they knew what they were doing when they brought you here." It wasn't comforting, but I nodded again, and Holt steered me toward the door. "Smile, Your Majesty," he said, "and all will be well." Servants opened the double doors, revealing the throne room beyond. "All bow to Her Majesty Queen Freya, ruler of Epria," a guard shouted. People must have worked nonstop to transform this room since the feast after my coronation. Banners hung from the ceiling, still bearing King Jorgen's sigil, and paintings were hung on every inch of the walls, making it look slightly less like a dungeon. The coldness had lingered, though, even with the crowd now waiting inside. Some of the people were familiar. Fitzroy was there, and Torsten Wolf. But there were many strangers, too. 100 unfamiliar faces, all staring at me, expectantly, eyes burrowing under my skin. "Smile." I just had to smile. I could feel the corners of my lips straining, the muscles in my cheeks twitching. They must all have seen the falseness of it, the fear in my eyes. I slowly crossed the room, heading for the throne. I wanted to stare straight ahead, to pretend I was walking alone, pretend it wasn't real. But I couldn't. I forced myself to look left and right, to meet people's eyes, to smile to them, challenging myself to notice the details. This time, I didn't trip. That was a blessing, at least. I stopped in front of the throne and felt another jolt of fear. The throne had belonged to the king and had been designed for a king's frame, a king's clothes. My skirt was twice as wide as the seat, and the crinoline was not going to bend. I wouldn't fit. I could possibly sit over the throne, my skirts wringing it and hiding it from sight, but that didn't exactly seem like a dignified solution. But it would be fine. It was fine. I'd just have to stand. Standing would be fine. I tried to turn gracefully to face the nobles, but the skirt was too large and I wobbled. A few people in the audience laughed behind their hands and my face flushed. But I could do this. I could do this. I just had to say the speech and everything would be fine. The words caught in my throat. I knew them. I did. But they wouldn't travel from my brain to my tongue. 100 people watched me, waiting, judging, expecting me to fail. And the more I snatched for those perfectly memorized phrases, the quicker they danced away. The silence stretched on. "Welcome," I said eventually. It came out as a rasp. "Welcome," I said again, but that time the words sounded too loud, like I was shouting at them. Had my tongue always been this large? The room spun at the edges. I could do this. I could. I just had to speak, just speak. "I am delighted to welcome you all back to the Capitol, although it grieves me that we must meet under such tragic circumstances." That was right, wasn't it? The words were stiff, entirely unnatural, but I was speaking them. It was all right. "We have all lost so many friends in this tragedy, and I know we will all feel their absence tonight. But I also know that we are strong, and we can come together in our grief to honor and remember them, and forge Epria anew." Once I'd started, the words tumbled out, with the ebb and flow that my father had drilled into me, over and over again. The rhythm of them took over, and I lost any sense of what I was saying or where I was. I just spoke and gestured, letting it happen. And then the nobles were applauding, and I crashed back into myself, swaying on my feet. I had done it. I'd reached the end of the speech. It hadn't killed me. I didn't really know what had happened or what I had said, but my father was smiling at me, and Holt was walking forward, and I'd done it. I felt proud, flush with my success, but I seemed to have rushed through 2 days worth of energy to support myself through that 2-minute speech, and I needed time to sit now, to recover. But of course, we weren't finished yet. I had to meet all of the guests, every single one, in a never-ending parade of bows and curtsies. "This is Sir Leonard, Your Majesty, and his wife, Isabella," Holt said, as the first couple approached. "They have traveled here from the moorlands in the east."
"Oh, we were so heartbroken to hear of what happened at the feast," Lady Isabella said, sinking into a curtsy. "So many good people. It must have been so painful to be there."
"I was not there," I said. "I didn't see."
"Thank the forgotten for small mercies, I suppose."
"I remember your mother, Your Majesty," Lady Isabella said. "She was a wonderful woman. She lit up every room she was in. I was much grieved to hear of her death."
"Thank you," I said softly. "So was I."
"Your Majesty," Sir Leonard said, "when the business of the funeral is over, I am hoping we can discuss the issue of taxation over the marshlands. The people there are not rich, as I'm sure you know, and these high taxes from King Jorgen are putting an unnecessary burden on—"
"I will be delighted to discuss such matters with you," Holt said smoothly.
"Or perhaps you could discuss them with the treasurer, Her Majesty's father, after the funeral, of course."
"I can discuss it with you," I said, the blunt words bursting out of nowhere. "If people are struggling, I want to know about it." Holt stared at me, and I faltered. "Although, I'm sure my father will be able to provide more help, but if you wish to discuss..." I ran out of words, as suddenly as they'd appeared, but Leonard was looking at me slightly differently now, appraising me.
"Of course," he said. "I will take you up on that."
More people followed, and I tried to greet them as I should, but I felt slightly detached from it all, and nothing seemed quite right. When I stretched my smile wide and tried to be friendly, welcoming, I felt like I was mocking the occasion, too cheery for the funeral of the entire court that came before. When I attempted to be somber, I was too quiet, too cold, an unwelcoming figure with nothing much to say. And when my true thoughts burst through, I felt a rush of relief,
just for a moment, before I remembered how unqueenly I was being, and shoved the thoughts away. After what felt like days, we settled down for the evening's first entertainment. A stage had been built at one side of the hall, and the crowd flowed toward it. A few chairs had been placed there, too, mostly for elderly nobles, but one nearest the stage, for me. And it had no sides, no arms, which meant I might actually fit in it, skirts and all. I sank onto it, grateful for the support. I couldn't quite catch my breath, and the sounds around me were a little too loud, buzzing in my ears, but this would be time to recover. Then I could face whatever came next. The performer was a storyteller, with a light box from across the sea. He told a story as the images shifted and changed, about a poor maiden whose younger brother had been caught stealing bread. She had dressed up as him to protect him, and had been sent into the army as punishment in his place. It had happened during Epria's dark days, when all was war and pain, and the Forgotten had left this world to its corruption. But the Forgotten still watched Epria, still exerted power when they wished it, and they favored this girl's bravery and intelligence. They protected her, gave her power, and helped her save the kingdom from ruin. The Forgotten were represented by many shadows and shapes, the twist of the wind, the silhouette of a dragon's wing, the elegant curl of a swan's neck. I knew the story, like everyone in court, but the performer was an excellent storyteller, and he made even the most familiar parts thrilling, capturing the wonder of this one poor girl with so much bravery inside her. I'd seen similar performances before, of course, seen the way artists manipulated light to animate shadow, the whirring picture boxes, the many distinct drawings transformed into one image by speed and flickering lights, the way parts could be added or taken away for greater effect. But I'd never seen a show like this. The light seemed to obey the storyteller's will, bringing the story to life. Beautiful, isn't it? I jumped. I hadn't noticed Madeline Wolfe move beside me. She leaned close, one jewel-covered hand resting on my wrist. The way they use the light? One has to be aware of it, of course, when one paints, but he seems to be able to control it here. So fascinating. I nodded. She leaned closer still, her painted fingernails digging into my skin. I wanted to warn you. Be wary of my cousin. What? I forced myself to look forward, eyes on the show. Your cousin? I murmured. Why? He is a good man and he means well, but he is blinded by his grief for the old king. I think he suspects you had a hand in his death. He doesn't have any proof yet, but he is not your ally, Freya. Be careful with him. Why are you telling me this? You saved my life, and you deserve to know. You're far better than he thinks you are. She leaned back, the same sweet smile on her face. Such talented work, she said. I must speak to the performer after it is done. She slipped away, leaving me to stare after her. My heart was pounding. I'd known Sten suspected me, certainly that he didn't like me, but it was different hearing someone else saying it, confirming my suspicions. Her behavior was so strange. Did she know more than she'd said? Was Sten plotting something? The show ended, and I applauded with the others, before hurrying toward the performer. Madeline's parting comment could have been a hint that the performer knew something, that I should speak to him myself. But Holt rested a hand on my arm, steering me firmly away. A good performance, was it not, Your Majesty? Yes, I said. I wish to thank the performer, to discuss his work. Oh, these men never want to reveal their secrets. Come, I think this story has given the court much to reflect on. It's time for the feast. And he shepherded me away. We were served peacock on golden plates, but no one seemed willing to eat the birds. People made a show of it, sticking their forks into the meat, even moving them near their mouths, but not swallowing a bite. I had to eat, to reassure people, but I could barely taste it. I had to force every chew.
I couldn't stop thinking about what Madeline had said during the performance, what I had said during the introductions. I really shouldn't have told Lady Patricia that I liked her hair. I'd meant it politely, but it had sounded forced, hadn't it? She probably thought I was mocking her. And that stupid smile I gave Sir Victor, he probably thought I was an empty-headed idiot. And my speech? I couldn't really remember much of it, but that was worrying, too. Maybe I'd mixed up the words and not noticed. Or what if I'd skipped part of it? And it was probably a monotone. And if they all thought I was bored of them... One of the visiting nobles stood. He held his golden goblet in the direction of the high table, smiling slightly. "A toast," he said, his voice ringing through the hall. "To our rightful queen, who protects us from harm." He raised the goblet higher and took a long drink. Everyone in the hall followed suit. I froze. The words sounded respectful, but something more sinister lurked underneath. A hint that I was not the rightful queen. The possibility that someone else might deserve the throne more. I had to do something, say something, act somehow, to put him in his place and take control of the situation, but my mind was blank. I couldn't make a mistake now, but what could I possibly do? I couldn't acknowledge the hint of a threat. I'd have to use pretty words and a prettier smile in response, and I didn't have either of those. Beside me, my father and Holt raised their goblets. I needed to raise mine too, or just nod, something. But my heart thudded faster and faster, and my hands tingled, and I couldn't move, could barely remember how to breathe. Smash! I jumped. Everyone stared at Fitzroy, who smiled and shrugged at a shattered ewer by his feet. Red wine spread across the stone floor. "My apologies, Your Majesty," he said, his tone not apologetic in the slightest. "My hand slipped. Seems I'll be playing the fool tonight." I forced myself to nod. He was a different person from the boy I'd spoken to in the dungeons, back into his courtier skin once again. But my breath was returning now, the world becoming clear. "Typical Fitzroy," a man near him said, his voice booming across the hall. "Can't bear for the attention to be off him for a moment." Everyone laughed, and with that, the conversation started again, more lively than before. I tried to catch Fitzroy's eye, but he did not look at me again. 14. I stared at my bed's canopy that night. Dagny curled up beside me. My room was almost completely dark, but I imagined I could see the patterns above me, the embroidery of fire-red birds and stalking panthers and glittering stars. The funerals would take place at dawn. The funerals. I rolled onto my side. I'd only ever been to one funeral before, and it wasn't one I wanted to remember. I'd had to keep telling myself that my mother was dead, repeating it over and over, drilling the words into my head. I still hadn't really believed them. Then the funeral came, and my final chance to say goodbye. The crowd had gathered around us, and I remember wondering what they were doing there. Hating them for stealing this moment, as though any of them could possibly miss her as much as I would. And then it hit me, all at once, that my mother was gone, that she was never, never coming back. I didn't remember much of what happened next. But people told me. I'd screamed, refused to let the priest near the body on the river, fighting and kicking and shrieking. Tomorrow, I'd be the one intruding on people's grief, pretending it was my own. No one I loved was being remembered tomorrow. I hadn't lost anything. And yet, I was to stand in front of them all, as though my sadness mattered most. I couldn't bear it. I swung my legs out of bed and stood. I needed a distraction, something to do, and my laboratory waited downstairs. I would head down there and work on my poison test, make sure nothing like this ever happened again. But when I reached the dungeons, the door to my laboratory was ajar. I pushed it slightly, letting it creak on its hinges. Fitzroy sat inside, reading through my notes. His blonde hair was rumpled, and his eyes bleary. He looked up when he heard the door and nodded at me. Once again, the charismatic courtier I knew was gone, leaving a softer presence behind. I wanted to run up and snatch my notes from his hands, protect my thoughts from his judgment. I wanted to rest my hand on his arm, to soothe some of that rawness away. "Fitzroy? What are you doing?"
"I couldn't sleep," he said.
"So you came here?"
I shut the door. The thud echoed in the room. Too loud.
"I don't know. I mean, yes, obviously. I hoped you would be here."
"Me?"
I stepped closer, slowly. My heart pounded. "I know you don't like me," he said, "but maybe that's what I need right now. I don't know. We were honest with each other last time. That was... I'm tired of being courteous, and I needed something to... I hoped maybe you were working and that I could help."
He looked so lost.
William Fitzroy was in my laboratory, rambling to explain himself, and I should have been angry. I should have. But the feeling wouldn't come.
"All right," I said. "You can help. Let me get some beakers."
My next planned test was to try dissolving the arsenic in water. I had no hope it would help. If it had a detectable effect, it wouldn't exactly be a useful poison, but I needed to explore every possibility, leave nothing to chance. As I prepared two samples of water, Fitzroy continued to leaf through my notes.
"These are very thorough."
"Of course they are. Otherwise, what's the point?"
Fitzroy just nodded.
I carried the beakers back to the center table and set them down a few feet from Fitzroy. I didn't let myself look at him. He was too distracting, the sheer presence of him, the way his feelings seemed to crackle in the air. I picked up a piece of pure arsenic with tongs and placed it in the water. Nothing happened. I poked it, as though that might encourage it, but it continued to sit, doing not much at all. The powder was similarly useless. It dissolved in the water, as I expected it would, but nothing else happened to reveal its presence. I scribbled down more notes as Fitzroy considered the liquid. I glanced at him, just once, twice. The lab felt too full with him here. Too full and too quiet. He thought I didn't like him, and I couldn't leave that hanging undisputed. I hadn't liked him before, but I'd never spoken to him. And now... I didn't know what I thought about him now. Nor did I understand this visceral something, a pull whenever he was near. "I don't dislike you." I inspected the arsenic powder as I spoke, like I wasn't even talking to him at all.
"What?"
I could feel him staring at me. I didn't look. "Before, you said I don't like you, but it's not that. I didn't know." I looked back at my notes, scrabbling for something to say. "We should test its acidity next, if you want to help. There's paper, somewhere in one of those drawers, pink-purple strips." I couldn't see his reaction, but I heard his footsteps as he walked over to the drawers and began pulling them open, rifling through my supplies. I could probably have remembered where I'd stored them if I focused hard enough, but I couldn't think. I could barely make notes.
"I'm sorry," he said, and I jumped. "You probably don't believe me, but I am sorry."
He was determinedly staring into a drawer, still searching for the paper. I had no idea what he meant.
"For what?"
I asked.
"For that first night at your coronation, when I said you didn't belong here, I was upset about my father, about all of this, and you were there, standing in his place, not fitting at all, and I wanted to tear you out of there. I wanted to rip everything back to the way it was before. But it wasn't your fault."
I didn't know what to say.
"Fitzroy, everyone calls me that, you know."
He pulled open another drawer.
"Fitzroy, King's son. They invented the name just for me, to make sure everyone knew I was different. Do you even know what my actual name is?"
"William," I said softly. William Fitzroy. I stared at my notes again. I hadn't thought.
I can call you William if you like. I didn't know.
No, he said. Don't. Everyone calls me Fitzroy. I call myself Fitzroy, but I don't know. I've never had an identity outside my father, and I never really counted.
You counted.
He made a soft sound of disbelief. You counted more than me. He didn't reply. Earlier that night, he had helped me, when that noble mocked me. Why would he have done that? Made himself look the fool in order to save me. Because he had saved me, in his way. I had been too trapped in my panic to react to the challenge, and he had reset the moment, distracted everyone, made things easy again. I walked to the row of jars against the far wall. There was nothing I needed there, but I had to do something, to move. I shifted the jars about, looking at the labels, not really reading them at all. Why did you help me at the banquet? The silence was a physical presence. It loomed behind me, growing. Growing as Fitzroy did not reply.
I knocked over some wine, he said eventually. I didn't help you.
You made yourself into a joke to stop them laughing at me. I didn't know what to do, and you... I pressed my lips together. I appreciated it. The words were heavier than they should have been, too full of meaning, but I did appreciate it, more than I could express. Thank you.
You should be careful. Don't let people corner you like that.
I didn't mean to. I wanted to respond, but I couldn't think.
You could have done anything, he said. You could have nodded or smiled. You could have said thank you.
He made it sound so simple. I suppose it was, to him. It's not so easy. I know it should be, but I didn't have an excuse. I tried to be confident, to be elegant, to transform into the queen they desired. For hours I'd tried. I'd just run out of resolve. The pretense had lasted too long.
You're smart, Freya. I know you can outthink them.
I paused, my hand hovering over a vial of mercury. You don't believe that.
How could I not believe that? Have you seen this place, Freya? Have you seen what you're doing?
Court is different. It's not... This isn't about being smart. When I'm there, all the thoughts fly out of my head. It's like I'm not even fully in the room anymore. I can trust my instincts here, but there, I don't know what to do. I can't think what to do.
Then don't think. Go with your instincts, like you said.
But my instincts were wrong. They weren't the instincts of a queen, and I had to act as they expected or they'd never accept me. I chewed on my lip, that admission a truth too hard to say.
I found the paper, Fitzroy said. Should we do the test?
That meant moving closer to him. I felt every footstep as I crossed the room. He held out the papers, and I took them from him, careful that I didn't touch him.
What are we looking for?
He said. If it's acidic, the paper will turn red.
And that'll help us?
It's useful to know. I dipped the paper in the poison solution. It turned light red.
Acidic? Fitzroy asked.
I nodded. It's not enough to prove arsenic is present, but it's useful. Perhaps the kitchens can use this to test drinks, at least. Make sure nothing is suspicious.
That would help.
He continued to stare at the solution. So what's next?
Acid,
I said. We try and dissolve it in different acids and see how it reacts. If it has a smell or a color or releases a gas.
Acids, he nodded. What should I do?
I glanced at his hands.
Nothing. I don't have any gloves that'll fit you. Acid is dangerous. I'll be careful.
He looked down at his hands as well, and then glanced back at me, with a slight look of desperation.
Please, Freya. I need to help.
I shouldn't. I shouldn't. But collect some beakers, I said, and some pipettes. We'll need to use a different one for each solution. He was too close. He was at least a foot away from me, but he was far too close. I carried my notes over to the far table, where the bottles of acid all waited in a line.
Science was supposed to be calming. It always helped me focus, no matter what was happening around me. But with Fitzroy here, I felt scattered, so aware of him that I couldn't be aware of myself. We worked in silence for a while, except for the occasional question about measurements. I labeled each beaker as we went.
"This is good," Fitzroy said. "If you figure it out, not just for the testers. You could sell it to other kingdoms or paranoid nobles and merchants. The kingdom can always use more money."
"This kingdom doesn't need any more money. What would we do with it? Make a fountain of liquid gold?"
"Freya."
He paused until I looked at him.
"You really don't know, do you? The court is rich, but where do you think all that money comes from? The treasury is broke. We need money."
In all the years my father had worked for the treasury, he'd never told me that.
"Are you sure?"
"I'm very sure. So we sell some of the court's riches, some of those jewels, and the gold. We have lots of money, even if it isn't coin."
"You can't do that either. People won't like it. They'll think you're not fit to be queen. People won't trust you."
He watched me, unblinking, and I stared back, heat creeping across my face.
"It's a good idea," he added in a softer voice. "Selling the jewels. But it's not realistic. Not now. The poison test? That's good. If you can do it."
I looked away.
"I'll do it."
"How do you know?"
"Because there has to be a way. I'm not going to let myself fail now."
"And you feel that way about solving the murders?"
"I have to."
We had shifted closer again as we talked. He was less than half a foot away now, and I could have sworn I could feel the creases on his sleeves against my skin. He was so unsettling. Nothing about him made sense. I ran my fingers through my hair, shoving the sensation away.
"You have to," he echoed. "Because you cared about my father in the court? Or to protect yourself?"
The words should have stung. A fierce accusation, but from Fitzroy, it sounded like a genuine question. Like the answer itself less important than the act of knowing it.
"Partly to protect myself," I said quietly.
"Partly to protect everyone. If there's another attack, a lot more people could die. And it's my responsibility, isn't it, to make sure that doesn't happen? Not that it was your father's fault that everyone died, but... now that we're warned, my father was a horrible person."
I stared at him. The statement had come out of nowhere, shattering everything around it, but he continued to measure out the acids, like he hadn't said anything at all.
"What?
My father? He was awful. He didn't care about anyone other than himself."
He spoke levelly, but anger lingered beneath the words, the long-suppressed feeling pressing against the surface.
"If you weren't exactly who he wanted you to be, he'd punish you until you changed. And I was never who he wanted me to be."
"Fitzroy." I didn't know what to say. I didn't know him well enough to disagree.
I'm sure that's not true." "Of course it's true."
He sounded so matter-of-fact as he said it.
"He wanted me to be a real son, a real heir, but I couldn't. So then he wanted me to not exist at all. I couldn't do that either. If he'd picked one or the other, it would have helped, but he changed his mind several times a day. Even if I could do what he wanted, I'd never get the chance before he switched it again."
"You were a real son."
He laughed. "I told you, Freya. I've always had to work to make people accept me. I've always been a threat. If my father had a real son, I would have been a threat to him. If he didn't, I was a threat to everyone else. If I was too serious, I was a dull disappointment. If I was too frivolous, I didn't deserve the honor of being his son. And I could never give my opinions if they went against his, or refuse to give an opinion if asked. I spent every minute of my life trying to count. I tried so hard, I don't even know who I am anymore. And none of it mattered in the end."
I didn't know how to help him. I wished I did.
"What about your mother?"
I said instead.
"I don't know. She didn't really have a part in my life. My father wanted her forgotten."
"What happened to her?" He shrugged. She's gone. That's all anyone would tell me. I found out a little on my own, but... He sighed. Even after all that, I still loved him. I still wanted his approval. And now he's dead, along with everyone else, and I'm still... He shook his head. You asked me if I wanted to be king before? I don't know if I wanted to rule, but if I became king, that would be... I would have his approval then, wouldn't I? So yes, I wanted it. It was all I wanted sometimes, but I wouldn't fight you for it. I wouldn't fight anybody. It just... It meant something before. It doesn't mean anything now. I'm sorry. The impulse was too strong to resist. I reached across the gap and touched his arm. He looked down at my hand, and I looked at it as well, feeling the weight of it. Then Fitzroy stepped away, reaching for another bottle of acid, and my hand hung in the air where he had been. So, how about you? Are you ready for tomorrow? I closed my eyes. I'll never be ready for tomorrow. I had to be honest, too, but it was so difficult, my concerns so selfish. I feel like I'm going to be an intruder somehow. Everyone will stare at me and hate me for being there, when the people they cared about should have been there instead. They won't, Fitzroy said. Not tomorrow. They'll be too focused on themselves and their own grief to hate you for it. But I'll be there, right at the front, being queen, when I shouldn't be. I glanced at him, suddenly afraid. I shouldn't say that I wasn't really queen. Not out loud, not to anybody. But Fitzroy just shook his head. If people don't know you, they won't even notice you tomorrow. And if they do, they won't have the energy to spare to hate you. No one will really be watching. People are always watching. Normally. But not tomorrow. I always thought... I paused, pulling my thoughts together. I assumed it was easy for you. Everyone always seemed to like you. I would have thought that it was easy for you. No one would really have cared what you did. I cared, I said, more forcefully than I intended. And my father. People who remembered my mother and how wonderful she was. I felt like everyone was watching me all the time, and I didn't want to be part of it. I wanted to be here, with my science. But you forced yourself to try. No, my father forced me. I let out a breath. I was going to leave, to study, be a scientist, make big discoveries. Far away from here. I can't do that now. You could, he said softly. No, I can't. I'm supposed to be queen, and if I don't hold on to this throne, but you could, he said, more forcefully this time. If you went far away, across the sea and changed your name, and never mentioned this at all, they'd make Madeline Wolfe queen, and as long as you never challenged them, most people would forget about you. And those that didn't probably wouldn't be able to find you. You could leave. The possibility had never even occurred to me. I could go. Run far away. Follow all my dreams after all. But the thought wasn't as relieving as I'd have expected. It just made me tenser, more anxious, faced with a possibility that I knew, deep down, I could never pursue. That plan had belonged to the Freya of a week ago, and she felt as far away now as if she were a dream. I couldn't leave. I had to make things work here. I won't leave, I said. Silence filled the laboratory again. And then, so softly I almost didn't hear it. Good. 15. We watched the river as the sun rose. The nobles sat in huge stands along the banks, dressed in the soft yellow of sunlight and spring. Their jewels glittered in the dawn. Everyone else stood farther down the river. The crowd heaved as people pushed forward to reach the water. Many of them held flags or banners, some official, with the three stars of King Jorgen, some crafted from old clothes and scraps. A few unscrupulous merchants walked the street near the bank, offering tokens to wave for the king's final journey, alcohol to toast him with, special lucky coins to toss as the bodies passed. The dead were by the riverbank, too, upstream of the crowds. Hundreds of wooden boats bobbed in the water. Some were plain, but others had carvings on the sides, etched names or drawings that represented the person or their family. The richest victims lay in elaborate boats, given swan necks or mermaid tails, or the wings of a hawk, with silks as blankets. The king and queen lay in a boat together, on a mattress of gemstones. The jewels wouldn't get far. People would be scouring the river as soon as the funeral was over. Even a single stone could feed a family for several years. People would fight over them. They would drown in the river for the hope of finding one. It was such a waste. All of this was a waste. I glanced at Fitzroy. We stood on a wooden platform by the water's edge, inches from the royal boat and his father's body, but he wasn't looking at them. He stared resolutely at the trees on the opposite bank, his jaw clenched. I wanted to reach out for him, as though doing so could fix even a tiny part of this. But the priest from my coronation stood between us, talking on and on, flanked by huge glowing metal torches. "We can take comfort in this tragedy," he said, "that our beloved king and queen, all those we loved here, have now begun their journey to join the forgotten. Their travails in this realm have helped to move them closer to their true place in this world, and they await us in the bliss to come." Dawn was coming, reds and golds spreading across the sky. The priest bowed his head at me, and I stepped forward, a huge wooden torch clutched in my hand. My dress floated around me. I held the torch above the fire. The flames leaped across, and I flinched at the sudden heat. All along the riverbank, other people, relatives of victims or important well-wishers, raised their own lit torches. Naomi was somewhere in the mass, I thought, as I glanced over all the flames. I hoped she was all right. I stepped toward the bodies of the king and queen. They had been doused in pitch, and the smell partly disguised the slight stench of decay that even the best preservation attempts could not stop after a week of death. They both looked peaceful, eyes closed, faces relaxed. Someone must have arranged them, I thought dully, to cover up the horrors of their deaths. The queen looked younger without her hair piled a foot in the air. Kinder. The king looked as stately as ever. I knew they were dead. Of course I knew. But my stomach jumped when I thought of setting them alight. They looked so real, like maybe we could wake them if we just shouted loud enough. If I burned them, they'd never get that chance. "Your Majesty," the priest murmured. Everyone was waiting for me. I stretched out my arm, the torch shaking slightly, and touched the flame to the king's feet. The fire caught with a rush, sweeping over the two bodies. I stepped back, and Fitzroy moved forward, his father's sword in his hand. He cut the boat free with one quick stroke. The current swept it up at once, carrying it downstream as the flames grew and grew, black smoke billowing. Once the boat reached the middle of the river, people all along the banks lit the other boats too, cutting them free so they followed the king. "May they find peace," the priest intoned, "and may we meet again." "May we meet again," the crowd repeated, but the solemnity of the words was belied by their enthusiasm. As the king's ship passed, they waved their flags and tossed their lucky coins into its wake. Some cheered when the coins landed on the ship itself, as though the feat had won them extra luck for themselves for years to come, as though it was lucky to throw in your lot with someone who had died at his own birthday celebration. Already, jewels were falling from the ship, sparkling in the water as they fell to the riverbed. How long would it be before someone dove in after them? The first of the other boats pulled level with me. I stared at those fires, too, at the faces being swallowed by the flames. Fitzroy still stood beside me, inches away now, staring at the water, seeming to see nothing at all. I wanted to comfort him, to do something, but I barely knew him, and even taking his hand felt like an intrusion. So I stared at the water, and so did he, as the boats passed. Coins splashed into the water, the wood crackled and buckled, and the crowd cheered and wept and waved the old court away. My carriage rattled through the streets after the funeral. The horses plodded so slowly that I could have walked faster myself. I sat alone in an open-topped carriage as crowds of people pressed around me. I had assumed, naively it seemed, that most people would be by the boats, giving me a quiet journey home. But either people had chosen to wait here, or they had left the funerals before me, because the streets were packed now. I forced myself to take a deep breath. Fitzroy had been wrong here, too. The nobles might have been too consumed by grief to watch me, but many people weren't. The crowds stretched on forever, tens of thousands of them, each with their own voice, their own thoughts, their own reasons to reject me. People were shouting different things at me, but all the voices mixed together, the words indistinguishable beyond vague cries of, "Your Majesty!" Then something wet splatted against my face. I flinched away, my hand flying up to rub my cheek. Sticky red liquid clung to my fingers and dripped onto the blue silk of my dress as another tomato splattered against my shoulder. I looked up, my heart firing into overdrive. "Long live the Queen!" a woman said, as she hurled a rotten turnip at the carriage. It struck the door and exploded on impact. The rest of the crowd shifted away from the group as my guards advanced, grabbing the protesters by the arms. "Long live the Queen!" they all shouted again, voices ringing together as they were dragged away. I wiped my cheek with shaking hands. What had I done to earn that? Rotten fruit was a huge step down from an attempted poisoning, but these people must still despise me, to risk themselves in that display. My carriage plodded on, and I leaned forward slightly, straining to hear the shouts of the crowd. They all still blurred together, but I could make out a few words being said over and over by different people. Money was one. Curfew. I spun around to look at the people I'd just passed. A woman must have realized that the crowd had my attention, because she leaped forward, grasping for my hand. "Your Majesty," she said, "Your Majesty, please, we couldn't pay the funeral fee, and my husband has been arrested. Please, let him go. We can't afford it. Truly, we can't, but no one will listen." Her pleas were cut off as a guard grabbed her and wrenched her away. "Wait," I said. "What funeral fee?" But the carriage continued on, the woman almost out of earshot. "Stop," I said to the driver. "Stop, I have to speak to that woman."
"I'm sorry, Your Majesty," the driver said. "It wouldn't be safe."
"That doesn't matter, I need..." But the woman had been swallowed by the crowd again, and the carriage was relentless, plowing its way down the street. I tried to look ahead again, feeling suddenly sick. I had no idea what the woman had been talking about, but I should have. I was queen, and people were getting arrested in my name because they couldn't afford to pay for all this? And no one had told me? The words hit me like a punch to the chest. I was queen, and I had no idea what was happening in my kingdom beyond the fort's walls. I'd been concerned with the murder and with the nobles while my advisors were doing things in my name, making decisions that changed people's lives. No one had told me about a curfew. No one had told me about a funeral fee. I hadn't known to ask, but I should have. It was my responsibility now, but I hadn't recognized it. Like the jewels in the ships, I'd looked at them not an hour ago and thought about how wasteful they were, how people would drown in the river to find them. I'd thought it, and I'd done nothing, even though I was the one person with the power to change it. If people drowned in the river, they should blame me. If we didn't have enough money to fund the kingdom after throwing all those gemstones away, that was my fault. I hadn't thought. I was spending all my time worrying about murders and nobles, a single threat, and a couple of hundred people at most, when hundreds of thousands of people filled the kingdom, their lives relying on whatever I did. And no, I hadn't made any of these decisions. I hadn't even known they were being made. But I was queen. Ignorance wasn't an excuse. As soon as my carriage stopped in front of the fort, I leaped out and marched through the front gates. I had to find my father. I had to speak to him. I didn't have to search for long. He was waiting for me in the corridor. "Freya," he said, "what happened? I need to speak to you right now. About the tomatoes. Freya, what? Right now." I strode over to a side room and yanked open the door. I was almost shaking with anger. I was failing, and my father was letting that happen. He was treasurer, wasn't he? And he hadn't told me. He hadn't told me. "What's the funeral fee?" I said, leaving the door to hang ajar behind us. My father frowned, like he still couldn't understand what this was about. "It's a fee, Freya, to pay for the funerals. I never agreed to a funeral fee. We needed to fund the funerals somehow. Freya, why are you asking me about this? A woman grabbed me in the street." My voice was shaking. My whole body was shaking. "She said she couldn't afford to pay the funeral fee, so her husband was arrested." My father nodded. "We have to be fair to everyone, Freya. Everyone must contribute. There must be consequences if they refuse." "They're not refusing if they can't afford to pay. Are you actually saying that you're arresting people for being unable to help fund a funeral where we burned silks and threw hundreds of jewels into the river?" "May I remind you, Freya," my father said, his voice sharp now, "that you are the one who wanted us to involve all of the dead in the funeral. That was not cheap. If all the city's dead were included, all the city must pay for it." "But it wasn't all the city. These were nobles who died because they ate a cake that was literally made of gold. And then we say we can't afford their funerals, so people in the city have to go hungry to pay for it?" My father rested a hand on my shoulder. He looked annoyed now, as though I were the one being unreasonable. "Freya, calm down. You don't know what you're talking about. If I don't, it's because you kept this a secret from me. I am the queen. Me. You are not to impose any more fees, any more laws, without my explicit agreement. Do you understand? Freya, do you understand?" My anger was spilling out, washing all shyness away. My father had betrayed me in this. He'd done an awful thing, and claimed it was in my name, and I couldn't let it happen again. Not ever. "I am your father, Freya. And I am the queen. Either you agree that all my laws will pass by me, or I will find a new treasurer." My father stared at me. "This woman was taken by the guards. I want her and her husband freed, and the fee will be returned to every commoner who paid it. Freya, all of them!" My father's eyes glinted with fury. "We will discuss it at the next council meeting, Your Majesty." "Yes, we will discuss the progress you've made tomorrow, and bring me a copy of Gustav's book then, too. I need it." I wouldn't let my counselors keep me ignorant any longer. I spun back to the door and jumped. Madeline Wolfe stood there, hand raised, ready to knock. "I'm sorry to interrupt, Your Majesty," she said, "but they're waiting for you in the hall, and I heard you needed to change. I came to help, but if it is a bad time..." "No," I said. I took a deep breath, forcing the anger down. "Away. No, we're finished here. Thank you." Madeline followed me up to my rooms in silence. When we reached my bedchamber, she stepped back, looking over my dress. "This will have to go," she said. "But if we dab at your hair and rearrange it slightly, I think we can get away without washing it. Otherwise, it'll be hours before dinner." She searched through my wardrobe for something else I could wear. The choice couldn't have been particularly inspiring for a girl like her. A few of my old dresses, a few of the queen's dresses that we didn't know what to do with, and the four or five new dresses that had already been completed by the sleep-deprived seamstresses. "I was going to ask you if you wanted blue or yellow, but it seems we won't have that choice." She leaned back, head tilted in thought. "Red," she said finally. like sunrise. You'll blend in with all the yellow, but still stand out. And this neckline will look perfect on you if we add a single chain.